to grasp marked sitting. It's not reaching the principle. This section, when studying this with my teacher Tenshin Roshi, he felt that this section was kind of like the heart of the fascicle, this next paragraph. At that time, this is the pivot around which it turns, or this says it most directly. So Nan Yue says, if you grasp the mark, the characteristics of sitting, you're not reaching its principle. Principle is a Chinese Buddhist term, I think got really brought out by the Huayan school, the Avatamsaka school in China, where they talk about principle and phenomena. In Japanese, Ri and Ji. Maybe also came up in Taoism and pre-Buddhism. So it's a little bit like form and emptiness. Principle is like the inconceivable ultimate truth, and phenomena, of course, is like the conceivable things of the world. The terms come up in that early Zen poem of Sekito Kizen, where he says, phenomena interact like box and lid fit, joining, like box and lid joining. Principle accords like arrow points meeting. A little bit like phenomena, actually, it's not actually just completely separate things. Phenomena dependently arise, they interact, they meet like boxes and lids. A box is dependent on its lid, and a lid is dependent on its box. Two different parts, but two different phenomena. But they interact quite nicely, the way this world works. Quite nicely means sometimes it's quite painful, but still, the interaction is, there's this perfect harmony of phenomena, like box and lid meeting. We can see a box and a lid, and we can see how they meet, just so. But principle, like arrow points meeting, head on, like acupuncture needles meeting head on, like very, very sharp arrow points, where, you know, if you have a complete point where there's no width to it at all, meeting another point where there's no width to it at all, like, where they meet is like, there's nothing there. In a way, they don't actually meet if they're that sharp, right? If they're infinitely sharp. The tiniest point of meeting, almost like no point. Or inconceivable meeting. Arrow points meeting I am taking that poem to be not so much like phenomena like box and lid fitting that you can see and they work together and they function very well, but the way that arrow points would meet head on is like something inconceivable. Do we say principle responds? Like a phenomena exist like box and lid. Principle accords like arrow points meeting. Phenomena exist, principle accords. Maybe we can also say like the inconceivable Buddha nature is just a cord, or maybe our Buddha nature meeting the vast, boundless Buddha nature is like arrow points meeting. Anyway, principle, phenomena and principle. So if you grasp the mark of sitting, you're not reaching the principle, the ultimate truth of sitting, that kind of principle. The true ultimate sitting. So remember, this is in a story about if you think that you're sitting in this particular posture, your zazen is like this, and you're grasping the characteristics of the sitting posture, that sitting posture that you're in, grasping that sitting, like it has some legs crossed like this and some hands in a mudra like this, grasping those marks, even just by like knowing them as sitting, that's not reaching the principle, the ultimate truth of sitting. That's the gist of the original story. So now Dogen says, to grasp the mark of sitting here means to reject the mark of sitting and to touch the mark of sitting. So this is where the interpretations of this Dogen part start to diverge. And looking into the characters, it could be read in different ways. Grasp the mark. The word grasp is, I think, the character that's used for upadana. We were talking about grasping this morning. I don't think you'd really translate it any other way. To grasp the mark of sitting, to attach to get a hold of. But this reject, the character for reject, can also be translated as like relinquish or renounce. Is what's used for renunciation or let go. And that has a very different quality. You can imagine how the character could be used to renounce and to reject are somewhat similar, but as practitioners we know that they're very different. Like dropping off, letting go, renouncing is very different. That's the practice, right? And then we say to reject something is to push something away, to try to get rid of. And that's not the practice. So that character leaves a lot of room there. So one translation actually says, let go of the mark of sitting. And to touch the mark of sitting, that character touches the same one that's used later in Hungjur's poem, where he says zazen's like knowing without touching things. That came up this morning too. Touching in this case, in this kind of poem, means like to make contact with an object. A subject and object contacting. That's also one of the 12 links of causation, right? The contact. So the zazen later in this poem is like a knowing, an awareness without touching things. The awareness doesn't touch things. In other words, it's like an objectless awareness. So it's the same touch here. And since Dogen's using it, is well aware that he's about to comment on that character in a kind of negative sense later, as a kind of touching is a little bit like a very subtle kind of grasping, I would read it that way. So I like the way that Carl translates it as, to grasp the mark of sitting means to reject the mark of sitting and to touch the mark of sitting. But you could read it quite almost opposite, like so Shohaku Okamura says, to attach to the sitting form means to let go of the sitting form and to hold up the sitting form. And apparently a lot of other Japanese commentators classically interpret it this way, that Dogen, like he often does, they're saying he's reversing the usual meaning. He's saying to grasp the mark of sitting, he turns into a positive thing. So, and that's how I think, maybe because of that precedent, Okamura Roshi says, to attach or to grasp the sitting form means to let go of the sitting form and to hold up or maybe uphold the sitting form, which sounds like that would be the practice, right? To let go of while upholding it. And that means to attach to it in this kind of positive twist. But also, the footnote here is in his commentary on this difficult passage, we admit this is a difficult passage, this heart here, Nishiari Boku-san, who is Suzuki Roshi's teacher's teacher, and also one of the a great, in his time, in the late 1800s, one of the great scholar practitioners of Soto Zen. So Nishiari Boku-san advises us to take the verb grasp here to mean complete identification with sitting meditation, and to understand the expression not reaching its principle to mean has already reached its principle. Why would he do that? Because these are Zen people. And Dogen does stuff like that, so maybe inspired by his turning meanings around to their opposite expressions, Nishiari Boku-san understands grasp. I mean, I could see how you could say grasp is like complete identification. Grok. Like in the Gendo Koan, I don't know what the character is, but we say, what is it, to grasp things directly. When you see forms or hear sounds fully engaging body and mind, you grasp things directly. That's a positive connotation of grasp. And I think in that case, Dogen means complete identification with things. Fully engaging body and mind, there's complete identification or oneness with things. That's grasp things directly. So maybe that's how Nishiari Boku-san reads this. Not reaching its principle means has already reached its principle. That's a stretch, maybe. And then Karl Bielfeld says, he's probably right that to make sense of this passage, we must assume here that, again, Dogen wants to give a positive connotation to both clauses of Nanyue's sentence. Though clearly in this case, we shall have to reach quite far for his principle. Karl likes to play with Dogen's words and his footnotes like that. We're going to have to reach quite far for his principle if that's what he's trying to say. So apparently that's one classical way of reading that, but maybe more straightforward, at least with this translation we have here. This is the way that I think my teacher said something like, well, those are also valid ways to read, but Tenzin Roshi himself felt like, I feel like this is really most vital and points to Zazen if we read it like, to grasp the mark of sitting here means to reject the mark of sitting and to touch the mark of sitting, which is basically just defining grasping, just like we were this morning, in a quite straightforward way. Definitely to touch the mark of sitting would be like, one mark of sitting is like, if I'm sitting like this, there's this characteristics of like, crossed legs and upright spine. And to touch that is to just basically know, oh yeah, this body is sitting in this particular cross-legged upright posture. doesn't have to be like total, strong, grasping this body. Just to know it as a cross-legged, upright body is like touching it in a way that separates the mind from the direct experience of the body, right? That would be like touching the mark of sitting. To reject the mark of sitting might be like, in this case, to say that, well, because, as you know, this story seems to be implying, this posture is not really what the mind of Zen is about, then it doesn't matter. Let's just reject the marks of the sitting form. Let's reject the upright posture and just like lie back on a really soft couch or something, and like, because it's really just the same. Or like, it just doesn't matter, right? That that we have to somehow go beyond this body, reject the marks of sitting, something like that. You can imagine other ways to think about rejecting as the opposite of grasping or touching. So the principle behind this is that in being a seated Buddha, we cannot fail to grasp the mark of sitting. You know, if you grasp the mark of sitting, you're not reaching this principle. But the principle behind this is that in being a seated Buddha, we cannot fail to grasp the mark of sitting. If we're actually being a seated Buddha, we must grasp the mark of sitting. Since we cannot fail to grasp it, though our grasping the mark of sitting is crystal clear, we are not reaching its principle. This kind of concentrated effort is called dropping off body and mind. So this is this heart of it. We cannot fail to grasp the mark of sitting. Even though our grasping the mark is crystal clear, so this could be, as we talked about this, you know, maybe like just to say cross-legged and upright spine, that's pretty general. Let's get into some subtleties of Zazen, like some qualities of Zazen, like some classic qualities of really present meditation are clarity, no thought arising, and blissful ease. these are three particularly that in the Tibetan Dzogchen tradition, they say these are like marks of very good sitting practice, meditation practice. If you can kind of check out if that's going on. Maybe it's not so often, right? That our meditation is the mind is very, very clear. It's very thought-free, virtually no conceptual elaborations happening. And it's, they say bliss, but very, very easeful. Like there's like no, we're free from all the kind of gross suffering. Clarity, non-thought, and bliss. And so in the Dzogchen tradition, they say to enter Dzogchen meditation, you have to destroy these three qualities, these three marks of meditation. What? These are like the best. I've been practicing all week just to have one period of clarity, non-thought, and blissful ease. Destroy that? And I think the reason they say that is very much like this paragraph here. It's like, these are marks. These are like characteristics of meditation. Very, very nice ones. But they block the complete flow of complete open non-dual awareness. Or in that Dzogchen tradition, they call it non-meditation. These three qualities are the marks of meditation, a very excellent meditation practice. But if you want to practice non-meditation, you have to destroy or drop them off, basically. We could say kill them, or we could just say let them go completely. Cut through these wonderful marks of meditation to practice the great pinnacle of Buddha mind called non-meditation. Non-meditation, there's no marks. And just in that tradition, to clarify, just to make sure that we don't think that that means just like you're dead or something, or you're just totally zoned out, it's often said non-distracted non-meditation. Has no marks of meditation, but it's completely not distracted. Doesn't mean, oh, we're not meditating, so now we just go back to like thinking mind. That's our distraction. Non-distracted non-meditation is when we is what's completely free from all the marks of sitting. Yes, Patrick.
I was just going to talk about my confusion. Because even in this reading, and I guess I'm confused by all the cannot nots, but the last line comes up with such concentrated effort is called dropping off body and mind.
Yeah.
It seems like, I mean, if that's not a mark, it's certainly something that good practice.
And it's called that, you know, in quotes, which is kind of nice in a way. I didn't really realize that, but he doesn't say this is dropping off body and mind. He says it's called, in quotes. And again, this the subtlety here is, in being a seated Buddha, we cannot fail to grasp the mark of sitting. In other words, we're always grasping the mark of sitting, even though the grasping of mark of sitting is crystal clear, and we could say examples of crystal clear marks of sitting are clarity, non-thought, and blissful ease. Even in that crystal clarity, we're not reaching its principle. This kind of concentrated effort, and I think this is where the one interpretation is, this kind of concentrated effort is the effort that realizes that the slightest idea about our practice, even non-thought,
yes,
bliss or clarity, doesn't reach the principle. To understand that, while still in the midst of bliss, clarity, or non-thought, or less crystal clear marks, like even just like, oh, this is so like not zazen now. That could be another mark. I'm so unconcentrated. That would be like a mark of like maybe like unconcentrated zazen. But to realize that all those marks, the really good ones and the really bad ones, don't reach the principle. Let's see, to realize that, or the concentrated effort of understanding that not reaching the principle, is called dropping off body and mind. Is that the concentrated effort? I'm maybe kind of adding in here.
Concentrated effort of not grasping it, even the slightest.
No, I would say I understand it as the concentrated effort to continue grasping, because being a seated Buddha is always grasping. But to continue grasping, but knowing that the meditation we're doing doesn't reach the principle and never reaches the principle. Anything we can ever know or say or experience, we could even go that far, anything we ever experience doesn't reach the principle. The concentrated effort at like penetrating that completely, realizing that completely, is dropping off body and mind. This is Tenzin Roshi's take on it. In other words, it's not about actually finally getting over this grasping the mark of sitting. If we do, that's fine too, but then we don't have a sitting Buddha. If we have a sitting Buddha, this is always a sitting Buddha is always grasping the mark of sitting. And I think that gives a subtle grasping anything we can ever know. And I think it's saying that realizing that any possible idea of Zazen, even the slightest one that we wouldn't even call ideas, like total clarity, but a sense, a somewhat conceptual sense, maybe conceptual is too rough even, but that any experience, basically any meditative experience we have, isn't reaching the completely inconceivable source, is dropping off body and mind. Or what's the other, when we chant at noon, right? It's like all this, Dogen's talking about this interpenetration of the walls, tiles, pebbles, and giving rise to wind and water and the whole interdependent universe. And then he says, all this, however, does not appear within perception. It's unconstructedness and stillness. So in that way, it's like, he's saying all this stuff, but like, we don't understand this, and we're not supposed to. If we think we understand it, that's, then it appears in perception, and that's not it. So it's like, it's inherently inconceivable. Yes.
But what contradicts that is the no thought, the no mind. I mean, once
it's
in there, then the rest of the stuff doesn't mean anything.
Well, I think in that case, and that's part of the subtlety and kind of, a little radical twist in there in this particular Dzogchen tradition that I'm talking about, to say that, yeah, no thought is a very, very slight mark. Very, very slight. So is clarity, right? Clarity.
Clarity, I can see, but no thought is different.
Yeah.
Clarity.
It's not, yeah.
Thought.
No thought, but still maybe the slight sense that, like, there's a slight sense that there's a person here who's not thinking. You know, that's the question. Can there be a kind of some dualistic consciousness without thought? Maybe that's a question I've had for a long time myself, actually. And my current understanding is that I think there can be non-conceptual experience that's still dualistic. We're talking about very, very subtle here. So my understanding is that non-conceptual and non-dual are very, very, very similar, but not exactly the same. And partly what I'm based that understanding on is that consciousness is inherently dualistic. What we call mental consciousness, vijñāna in Sanskrit, means divided knowing. It's like, so even when the consciousness is just completely resting and it's not like caught up in any objects, but there's still the mental consciousness happening, that's still different from jnana, like the perfect mirror wisdom, or the undivided non-dual mirror wisdom. And in the Yogacara tradition, they talk about how all the different dualistic consciousnesses, all the vijñanas, are transformed or are dropped off, we could say, and are revealed to be non-dual jnana, undivided knowing. So we're talking about something very, very subtle here. But just according to tradition, and checking with some teachers, it seems like there's some agreement on this. Now, how this plays out in our experience, maybe we could say in our experience, it's like there might be times when our zazen is very, very, very still, very, very quiet. Thinking has settled down so much that it's virtually not happening at all. Just little tiny wisps coming and going. But there might still be a sense. This is, I'm kind of like stretching here a little bit, so this, don't hold me to this, but I would propose that there could be like a very slight sense that's different than a thought, but a slight sense of duality. A sense that like, not a thought that there's somebody here meditating, but a slight sense that there's somebody here meditating. I think often in those times in zazen, it's like we actually don't remember that we're in zendo, and sometimes we actually don't even remember we're in the body. Still, maybe this slight sense. It's like it's not completely broken open into like into complete not knowing. But I don't even think we need to go that far, actually, about the non-thought part. Yeah, that's not in the text. This is just saying, in being a sitting Buddha, we cannot fail to grasp the mark of sitting. Since we cannot fail to grasp it, though our grasping the mark of sitting might even be crystal clear grasping, we're still not reaching its principle. And this kind is not clear in the text what it says, what this kind of concentrated effort, this kung fu concentrated effort, it's kind of open to interpretation, but one way to understand it would be like the concentrated effort to see that any possible slight way we can just touch it a little bit doesn't reach the principle. And knowing that, and knowing that it's okay, just because it never reaches it, this is called dropping off body and mind. Or maybe to also bring up, when we were studying this, maybe part of the attention Roshi got kind of excited here, because we were studying this Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra at the time, and with three natures. So without getting into a long story about this three natures, you know, there's the, basically, there's the other dependent nature, is the interdependent arising of all phenomena. And then the imputational, imaginary nature is basically, touching this interdependent world with our ideas, with our imputations. We impute, like, you know, there's an dependently arising something here. All the conditions of the universe are coming together to create an appearance of something here. And the imputation is, this is a book. And so that's like a projection of some actually existing book onto this interdependently arising, inconceivable event here. And that's two of the natures, the imputational nature projected onto the other dependent nature, and that's basically the source of suffering and grasping. And then the third nature is called thoroughly established nature, and the thoroughly established nature is defined as the way that the imputation never can actually reach the other dependent phenomena. Did you follow that? The way our thoughts never actually can touch this the way this world is happening. And the way they never touch it is the thoroughly established nature of phenomena, also called suchness. And that's what Buddhas realize. They realize that any of their thoughts, no matter how slight, imputation can be just, again, very, very subtle. Thought of something. The way that anything we think or the conceptual mind gets in there never reaches this constantly arising and ceasing appearance of the interdependent world. So the not reaching actually is what we call the thoroughly established. So though our grasping the mark of sitting is crystal clear, we have this very subtle imputation of clarity or bliss. We'll put non-thought aside for the time being. That's the hardest one, I agree. Bliss, though, we can definitely have a sense that, whoa, without even saying anything, there's a sense of blissful ease. It's a feeling, yeah? So, that, you know, imputation of bliss doesn't reach what's actually happening. And that not reaching is the thoroughly established nature of all reality or suchness. And we could say that not reaching, understanding this not reaching, is called dropping off body and mind. In other words, understanding the thoroughly established nature is dropping off body and mind. So
understanding is just
understanding's a hard we have to say realizing in a non-conceptual way. Realizing is a nice word because it just means actualizing it. It means to make it real. I agree. And any word is a little tricky because of the very thing we're talking about. Also, we have this story, right, that Bodhidharma and his disciple Waka practiced together for a long time. And one time Waka said, "Okay, teacher, I finally have ceased all involvements." And I'm free. I've ceased all involvements have ceased. And Bodhidharma says, "Well, that sounds kind of like nihilism. Or like you're dead or something." And Waka said, "Nope, it's not. It's not nihilism." And Bodhidharma said, "Well, prove it." And Waka said, "I am always clearly aware and words don't reach it." And so he could say that in words, right? Because he knows that the words don't reach it. "I'm always clearly aware, even to say that, the words don't reach it." And Bodhidharma said, "Yes, this is the nature of mind that all Buddhas realize. Have no more doubts." I could even say it's the not reaching. It's like we don't need to eliminate words. And like we were talking about the other day, right, that do we have to stop thought here in Zazen? Does non-thinking mean we have to cease all thinking? I don't think so. We just have to see that thought, no matter how refined the thought is, isn't reaching the principle. Or there's this clear awareness that the thoughts don't reach. Or there's a mirror that the images don't actually stick to. They're reflected on it, but the images don't stick to it. It's like, if they stuck to it, that would be like reaching. That would be like our experiences actually meeting the inconceivable mirror. Yeah.
If we reach... Mm-hmm. For such subtle points, is that asking for too much? Wouldn't we settle for blissful
clarity and non-thought?
I mean, I would.
Here's response.
Well, those marks you spoke of, clarity and blissful ease, that's called pliancy. Those marks you spoke of, clarity and blissful ease, non-thought, those are marks already of the jhanas, the highly concentrated states beyond the first jhana, because in first jhana there's still discursive thought. But you know, early in his practice, the Buddha went through all the eight jhanas, and he realized that, I mean, no matter how blissful they are, and if you die in them, no matter how many eons or kalpas you'll spend in former formless realms, that's still not it, and that doesn't eradicate suffering.
Thank you. That's a great point. Yeah, connecting that with the jhanas or with shamatha meditation, no matter how deep it is, without the insight. That's another way to put it. Or jhana without prajna.
In fact, someone just said to me recently, and if I had heard this before, I'd forgotten. He said, when the Buddha sat down under the Bodhi tree, he entered the jhanas, and he went all the way to the eighth jhana, and then he came back to the first jhana because he needed to have the faculty of discursive thought.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Very interesting. I've heard it that way too. Mm-hmm. In the super highest jhanas, it's like almost like prevents insight because it's too deep and it's too blissful. Like, why would I want, kind of like that, like, why would I want anything more than this? But you could say, it's not, part of the problem is that it's impermanent. That when you come out of that meditation after a 1 second or countless eons, then you're still in samsara because you haven't seen through. So we could say, if we're talking about the difference between the marks of the wonderful marks of super concentrated meditation versus the insight or realization of the thoroughly established nature, there's something very stable, because realizing the thoroughly established nature, you can come back into the world of imputations, but you realize that the imputations don't reach what's happening. So Waco could say, I'm always clearly aware, but like, he didn't say, but don't talk to me or I'm going to lose this. He said, you can talk to me and I can answer you. I am always clearly aware. I can even say I. How about that? But words, none of those words reach it. And because I've realized that the words don't reach it, then I can speak words. And I think it's easy to speak these words and say this kind of thing, but I think the realization of the thoroughly established that we're talking about, kind of as Nanette's bringing up, well, it's not just understanding it, it's not even realizing it, maybe even the way we're imputing the realization of it, I think is, you know, for it to be Buddha's realization, it just has to be thoroughgoing. And I think that's why Dogen says, this kind of concentrated effort, like, this is not just like, oh yeah, I get it, like, my words really aren't what's happening. We have to, like, thoroughly investigate, make concentrated effort to see there's no touching here, there's no... What was that line from Baijiang a couple weeks ago? I remember on a Wednesday night, came across this line that was like, If you realize that mind and objects never contact, you're set free on the spot. I think was the line. It was the same point, I'd say. Mind and objects seem to contact. The eye and color seem to be making contact here. But that's subject and object illusion. And it's not so bad, but the setup is a setup for a lot of painful situations. But if we realize that there's this appearance, but really the eye is not seeing something out here, and realizing it deeply. Yes.
trying to be able to put a picture in my head. But the flip side is, Dogen Dogen talks about practice and realization being unified. Throughout our practice, we talk about being, bodhisattvas, and us here on the cushion, and being sitting Buddhas. So there's got to be another way to talk about it, but this has to be an experience that
is accessible.
That we feel on some level that's motivating our practice. Those reasons that we talked about a few days ago about, why we sign up for Sesshin time after time, because there's something pulling us, because we feel that we're connected to it already, that this is our life.
I think there's various, reasons why we do come, and there's the ones that we can see, the ones we can, like our imputational reasons, why we can come up with them, those are useful because when we forget why, we can run through our list, our imputed list of the reasons why, and then there's the other reasons that we actually can't conceive of, like Buddha nature pulls us here. I mean, that's a story, but because we can't know that. So I think there's both kinds. And then this point about, is it accessible? Because I think the way this is sounding might be like, we have to, realize and just be the thoroughly established where almost like there are no imputations. But part of the way I understand that sutra, actually, at least an implication of that sutra about the three natures model is so nice because it never says that you eliminate imputations or thoughts or imaginations. In fact, you can't. It actually says all phenomena have these three natures. So, and they never get eliminated in some phenomena. So you could say if you could eliminate it, but then there's no phenomenon, there's nothing. So the nice thing is you don't eliminate, you just see that our ideas don't reach it. And I think that's one way to see what Dogen's saying here too, is that at least this one way of seeing it is that being a seated Buddha, like, we're not talking about a seated sentient being. A seated Buddha cannot fail to grasp the mark of sitting. We could almost say Buddhas must use the imputational nature. But though our grasping the mark of sitting may be even crystal clear, we know, we realize that that doesn't reach the principle. A Buddha can use thought and seems to use imputations and thoughts to teach Dharma, for example, and stuff, but knows that words don't reach it. So you could say it's not so much that we have to, again, it's not about eliminating thought here, right? It's that we're sitting. Maybe this is a highly elaborate way to say letting go of thought in Zazen, right? It's saying we're thinking about Zazen or about something else during Zazen, and we realize that it's not bad or something that we're doing that. It's just that there's a Zazen, we have faith, maybe even, or we trust, and maybe even realize on some level that true Zazen is free of all this, of all our thoughts about it. Therefore, we don't exactly need to stop. We can just relax into the present happening, and thoughts don't have so much force and weight. If we think, I gotta grasp it with my thought, or I gotta grasp something, then we're caught. So when we say letting go of thoughts, we could say, if we really understand that thoughts never really reach anything that's happening, that by realizing that very much, I think, helps us to release the thoughts. Is that too verbose, way to put it? And that way it's not so far-reaching. It's just like, another way to say this would be like, this. I told this story, right, about this Korean teacher. He's like, well, what's your practice? And it's just letting go of thoughts. And he was very critical of that, right? I just let go, and then, well, what happens next? Another thought arises, let go of it again. We might feel like, well, that's good enough for me, that practice. I felt like it was good enough for me. But that teacher was, I thought that was, it really stuck with me many years ago. He said that's like putting a rock on grass. And so we could say that if we make concentrated effort at realizing the principle that thoughts don't really reach what's happening, then letting go of thoughts is a little bit different thing. And it's not like, well, if I let go of it, then I'll finally find peace. It's like, no, because another one's going to come up, and it's going to happen endlessly like this. So maybe if I had said, I don't know, maybe if I had said to this Korean teacher, okay, now my practice is realizing that thoughts never actually reach the principle, no matter how often they come up. And I'm making concentrated effort at aligning myself with this truth. Maybe he would say, "Oh, okay, yeah, that can be a stable, unshakable kind of practice." Even when you're not concentrated. Something like that.
Well, I was going back to why we sit Zazen, and maybe it's a way of slowing down life, because we know that it's impermanent, and it makes us be something bigger that we are, since there's no self.
Hmm.
So it's a...
slowing down our busy life. To put aside all the stuff we're caught up in, at least on the gross level, to physically stop, be here, and goes a long way already, right? And then to let the mind come to rest more and more fully. Definitely, I think. Yeah, that is how clarity, non-thought, and bliss all arise.
I kind of like that.
So, maybe another way to say this too is that, this is Dogen's acupuncture needle of Zazen. So I think this is not actually like kind of like a beginner's instruction. I think this is like incredibly profound. And he criticizes all these people all over China say Zazen, but they don't really understand it. So I think if it was something really obvious, he maybe wouldn't talk that way. So I think he's talking about something very subtle, and it's nice to present this full range of what's possible and grope around in the dark ourselves and see. But that doesn't discount all the reasons and benefits of Zazen, apart from the subtlety. And also, in the realm of non-duality, the subtlety is not separate from just any moment of sitting, however we are. You know, in talking about it, since he's trying to circle around this with words, it's getting, you could say, very convoluted. And very challenging, and even all these Soto scholars are interpreting in different ways, trying to reach his principle. But meanwhile, there's just like, we're in Sesshin, right? So it's very nice that we, at some point, we stop and we just go back to sitting, and this is actually what's happening. I like how Okamura Roshi will sometimes talk about very profound principles of Zazen, and that he often says, and this is what's actually happening in our sitting, our everyday sitting, from the very beginning. He says this quite a bit. And he's like, huh? I thought you were talking about something totally out there that's like, I'm never going to practice like that. He says, no, it's a way of talking, but it's like, this is actually happening. And he says it like really definitively, like, sometimes I read that like, well, not in my sitting. Whose sitting are you talking about? But he says it, no, in everybody's sitting, this is actually what's happening. It's just that it's inconceivable. You know, it's not like the thoroughly established nature is something that has to be produced. It's actually the way things are. Suchness is the way things are. And we can realize it more and more deeply by realizing how both our gross thoughts and our subtle thoughts don't actually ever touch what's really happening. In a way, that's not so different from like what Rain was just saying of like, we stop our busy lives where we're really into like heavy duty imputation, you know, all day long of like, this is like this, this, I'm like this, I have to do that, and this is like this, and they're like that, and that's what we're doing all day in a really heavy duty kind of way, right? We're really caught up in our conceptualizing and thinking, and so Zazen is like calming that whole process down. So we're still imputing, but we're getting into more and more subtle imputations, and it's very restful. I would say that my understanding would be these jhanas that we're talking about, these very settled, clear, non-thinking, blissful states, there's still some very subtle imputations going on. We're talking about acupuncture needles, so excuse the degree of subtlety here. but I think it works on many, many levels, especially this three natures thing. You know, the way to apply this from the very first period of Zazen, I think the newest beginner to Zazen, you can see when you sit down and your thoughts are really racing, and you really feel like you have to like get out of here or do something, it's like just relax that whole thing, and then if you get kind of relaxed with it, then you can start kind of investigating your thoughts and say, is this really, do I really have to get out of here? Maybe not, actually. Maybe that was just an impulsive thought that like, maybe I don't have to act on that. In fact, I don't even want to get out of here anymore. That bone's passed. So I think we get familiar with our thinking patterns very naturally by sitting from the very beginning. And I think that is a great virtue of, maybe that's one way we could say all of us, I would say, I think that all of us understand that, you know, and we understood a long time ago that like our really obsessive thinking, we don't have to believe it completely, and Zazen helps us to not grasp the thoughts so strongly. How about that?
Yeah, or like she said, it helps us to slow down instead of acting on every impulse.
Yeah. So there's just, and that really does work, and it works enough to get us to sit even more than once a day and come to a sesshin and like, let's go even more deeply into that same practice of settling and non-grasping, in a way that we can't do just if we're sitting once a day. I think sesshin offers this potential for deeply exploring more and more subtleties of non-grasping. And so sometimes part of my grasping tendency is I like to get really into like the subtlest. Well, Dogen seems to, maybe he's going there too. But please excuse me if it gets too subtle, like you've done it, like the acupuncture needle got lost under the skin, and that's not good because it could cause an infection. You know, they say that sometimes in acupuncture, they're like, they said that to me. It's like, if you get home and you find some needles still in you, just pull them out. Because sometimes they put in hundreds and hundreds of them, right? And like, I said.
But I didn't think they went that far. They just go in.
Well, but they stick in there enough that that's why you can pull them out easily.
No, I've had them.
Yeah, you find them at home.
I
know. Yeah. Yeah. It's not such a problem. They're just like, I might have forgotten some. So, maybe we don't need to get into put in so many fine acupuncture needles that we start losing them and they get stuck in us and then they're like, you know, cause more disease maybe. This could definitely be doing that. Please excuse me. If so, now we've finished Dogen's comments on the story of Nanyue and Matsu. Since we cannot fail to grasp it, though our grasping the mark of sitting is crystal clear, we are not reaching its principle. This kind of concentrated effort is called dropping off body and mind. So just for fun, since this is kind of like a very dynamic place, let's just hear from the other translators. Since it's not possible to be non-attached, even if you're excellently attached to the sitting form, and he put in parentheses, and sit in perfect posture, you will never reach the principle of Zazen. Such effort is called dropping off body and mind. That doesn't sound so far from how we were talking about it. Do you want to hear that again? Since it's not possible to be non-attached, even if you are excellently attached to the sitting form and sit in perfect posture, you will never reach the principle of Zazen. And we think, oh, really? But then, such effort is called dropping off body and mind. I think it's celebrating the fact that we never reach the principle. Can't we reach the principle? Please, no.
So we're just doing everything.
But this is dropping off body and mind. The not reaching the principle is dropping off body and mind. But that's why it's so dynamic and so unusual. Because Dogen talks about dropping off body and mind just like, you know, let go of everything. Here, this is maybe his most unusual expression of dropping off body and mind. To be attached to sitting and realizing it's impossible to not be attached. It's impossible to eliminate the imputational character. Even the most excellent imputations of clarity and bliss and so on. You will never reach the principle. Such effort. Actually, it's emo, which is Dogen uses for like suchness. The emo effort. Such effort. We don't even know what effort he's talking about, right? So here's Nishijima says, because it is impossible not to be attached to the sitting form, although attachment to the sitting form is something brilliant, it may be not to have attained the principle of that sitting. Effort like this is called dropping off body and mind. And Kaz says, however clear the sitting form is, he has this thing about, he really changes it to be one with. He really changes the attachment to make it a kind of positive thing, identified with. To be identified with the sitting form, is to let go of and to touch the sitting form. The reason for this is that in being a seated Buddha, we cannot not grasp the mark of sitting. So there it's maybe implying we cannot not identify with. We're always are being Buddha. This is much easier in a way to deal with this way. We can, because grasping the mark of sitting is just identifying with sitting, and we cannot fail to be sitting like that. Since we cannot not grasp the mark of sitting, though grasping the mark of sitting is crystal clear, we are not reaching its principle. Such concentrated effort is called dropping off body and mind. Oh, no. I'm sorry, I went to Carl's. Kaz says, to be identified with the sitting form spoken of here is to let go of and touch the sitting form. The reason is that when one is sitting Buddha, it's impossible not to be one with the sitting form. However clear the sitting form is, the heart of the matter cannot be reached because it's impossible not to be one with the sitting form. To penetrate this is called letting go of body and mind. That's much easier to deal with. We don't have a problem with that, I don't think, yeah. However clear the sitting form is, the heart of the matter cannot be reached because it's impossible not to be one with the sitting form.
The heart of the matter cannot be reached.
What does it impossible not to
be one? I think it means like we can't separate from this, from the oneness of what's happening. That's how I hear it, is like there's just what's happening, this one expression, we can't really get outside of that. We can't, in other words, we can't avoid non-duality. Truly, which is often the way Dogen talks, right? It's impossible not to be one with the sitting form. To penetrate this is called letting go of body and mind.
It seems to me to be similar to what we were talking about yesterday, about something about the seated Buddha, including everything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Even when we think not, it's impossible to escape. That's what it was, right? It's impossible to avoid the seated Buddha, I think Dogen says, yeah, like that. So we could hear it was translated that way. I think these other translations give us this kind of problem, and they make for that possible very strange and radical interpretation of Zazen that Dogen's playing with, that he's calling dropping off body and mind. Isn't it funny that like when he says like, here I'm going to give it to you straight, this is my understanding of awakening, dropping off body and mind, but when it gets to the most important issue, it's not so straight. Very difficult. Everyone seems to admit that this is a very difficult passage. We'll leave it behind now. Those who've never sat do not talk like this. I'm sure that's true.
This is a challenging question, but I don't mean to be aggressive. Does it mean that if one is not a Buddhist, one cannot be enlightened?
No, I think it's just one can't talk that way. So you can realize how what we, that our ideas aren't reality without being a Buddha. But I don't think you can talk like this. You talk in some other spiritual language.
Right.
So you can say many great things. but if you haven't sat the Zazen and the Dogen speaking about, you can't talk like this. Luckily for those people who don't sit. Yes.
Maybe you could say, for those who don't sit Zazen, they for those who don't sit zazen, they can't express their enlightenment in that particular way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They very well may be enlightened, but they can express their enlightenment in another way, in
the
tradition.
Yeah.
Whatever, but
this way. Yeah, and expression is very important. So we could possibly, when we're into kind of like interfaith dialogue, we could say that the heart of all these spiritual traditions is the same realization. I'm not saying it is, but I'm saying we could say that, we could explore that. It may be the case. And then the difference is just in the expression. And so if you say, I'm a Buddhist, it means you like the expressions in the Buddhist tradition, and if I'm identify more with as a Christian, means like I same practice and realization, but I like those expressions better. Could be that's the only difference. Yeah, that it's the same. I think these realizations are not Buddhist, right? But the expressions of them, the particular way, both the way to express the realization, and especially the way to talk about the practice that to bring forth the realization is unique to each tradition. But those who haven't sat don't, in this kind of Buddhist sitting way, don't talk like this. Such talk belongs to the time of sitting, and to the person who sits, to the seated Buddha and the study of the seated Buddha. The sitting that occurs when the ordinary person sits is not the sitting of the seated Buddha. So this, if we have problems maybe with things like this. The sitting that occurs when the ordinary person sits is not the sitting of the seated Buddha. So it kind of sounds like, maybe by ordinary mean when you're just like, I'm just going to sit in a chair right now. I never heard about any kind of Zen sitting. I'm just sitting in a chair in my living room. Maybe that's going to be my ordinary sitting. And that doesn't necessarily realize that our thoughts about the sitting don't reach the principle. Although a person's sitting naturally resembles a seated Buddha or a Buddha's sitting, the case is like that of a person making a Buddha, or the person who makes a Buddha. Though there are people who make Buddhas, not all people make Buddhas. And Buddhas are not all people. Since all the Buddhas are not simply all people, a person is by no means a Buddha. And a Buddha is by no means a person. The same is true of a seated Buddha. So you can hear him saying some people get this and some don't, or we can hear this as the same type of talk about touching things and grasping things, that a person is not a Buddha and a Buddha is not a person. A person can't touch a Buddha and a Buddha can't touch a person because they're not separate. One way to hear. Here then is Nanyue and Matsu. In Nanyue and Matsu we have a superior master and a strong disciple. Matsu is the one who verifies making a Buddha as a seated Buddha. Nanyue is the one who points out the seated Buddha for making a Buddha. There was this kind of concentrated effort in the congregation of Nanyue and words like the above in the congregation of Yaoshan, who's the one who said non-thinking. So you might feel like you're not making such a concentrated effort, but I think the fact that you're putting up with listening to this kind of talk for this long, I think it counts as concentrated effort. It's hard.
Yeah, there'll be a test.
Dogen does not make it easy. That's why, I really appreciate doing these Genzo A sessions, because if you just kind of sit down at home and read this fascicle, it might be somewhat entertaining, and you might get through it like, whoa, that was like, what happened there? But it would be hard to put this kind of concentrated effort into this thorough investigation outside of Genzo A session. I know for myself this is the case. In fact, I thought before Sashin, this is a really hard fascicle, like every Dogen fascicle. I really like have to study this thoroughly before the Sashin. And you know, one thing came up after another, and maybe in the back of my mind, I'm like, I just don't make me do it. And I managed to avoid it right up till the Sashin started. Though I have studied in the past, and this often happens to me in Sashin. I have these high aspirations to like thoroughly prepare beforehand, and then it's kind of like, and study many things. You should see the piles of books in my room on my list to read with high aspirations. Not like I should, because I really love to study Dharma. I really want to, and yet many things come up to prevent it. So once that bell rings to begin the session, it's too late to turn back.
I know. Well, I got here yesterday morning and I started to have a little panic attack, you know. Just sitting here, I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do here? I'm stuck now.
Yep.
I'm with myself, can't escape.
Got here again.
I just talked myself off the ledge. You know, like, okay, just sitting, I mean, what could happen?
Just sit down on the ledge.
But your mind just blows up. It's just a really crazy thing to watch.
Especially if you start calculating how much there is to go.
I think this may be why people drink, you know.
Yep.
Numb it up.
Yep. And we only serve water in Sashin.
It tastes like an ambrosia.
Yes. Tastes like ambrosia.
Well, I really appreciate all of your work, Kokio. I mean, all the cross-referencing with Uchiyama Roshi, and I mean, you obviously love this.
I do love it, and I love this fascicle, and I love that really hard section that we barely made it through, and anything that was said today is not, I take all responsibility for mistakes. It's what's that?
It just stays here.
It just stays here, yeah.
Oh, definitely.
Just because, you know, this was such a juicy thing. I happen to actually have this Shohaku Okamura's commentary on this, most of this fascicle. It was published in a magazine called Buddhism Now. And I somehow got from November 2004. If anyone wants copies later, you can. It's not so different from the way we've been talking about it. There's no big surprises. And I think even this was not such a big surprise, but let's just see in this juiciest of sections. Maybe this part never got published in the magazine. I wrote to Shohaku when I was studying and teaching this some years ago, and he sent this transcript. I don't have the part about the poem, the next poem from him. Sorry. He maybe never taught it. If you attach yourself to the sitting form, you'll never reach the principle of Zazen. Again, So it's not possible to practice non-attachment to the sitting form, Dogen says, since it's not possible to be non-attached, even if you're excellently attached to the sitting form and sit in perfect posture or in bliss and clarity, you'll never reach the principle. And Shohaku says, this is not a negative statement. Not reaching the principle of Zazen is positive in Dogen's comment. So I think that's how we have to understand this, right? That not, you know, this not reaching is like the thoroughly established. Our ideas never reach it. I'm always clearly aware and words don't reach it. This is a positive thing.
Wasn't that what Dogen said? It's already having reached it or something, or it's already...
Even if you're excellently attached, you'll never reach the principle. And he says in parentheses, of Zazen. So when you first hear that, it sounds like, oh, really? We can't reach the principle? Please, can't we? And then you see, well, no, it's impossible to reach the principle. That's the whole point. We don't want to reach the principle. Because if we reach the principle, then we're like, you know, touching it as something. Anyway, he says, not reaching in this way is positive. So he talks about it kind of nice here. We're always in the process. We will never reach the goal. We're always inquiring and practicing and searching the truth endlessly. As a bodhisattva, we practice in the realm of desire. As Dogen's teacher, Tendo Nyojo, said, and Dogen recorded, the realm of desire means this world within samsara. Because of our bodhisattva vow, which states, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. We stay in samsara until all beings have entered nirvana. So this is a kind of, puts a compassionate twist on it. The principle might be like, if the principle is nirvana, the bodhisattva doesn't reach nirvana ever. They vow to keep using words, knowing that the words don't reach nirvana. This vow means we will not reach the other shore of nirvana until we fulfill this vow. A bodhisattva should be the last person to cross the river between samsara and nirvana. We cannot go there. This sounds strange, doesn't it? Not a single bodhisattva is on the other shore of nirvana. Everyone's here in samsara. This is the place where we practice. Not reaching the principle is not reaching nirvana. We practice right here, right now, embracing our desires and delusions, and we support and help each other. Practicing in this way, we are trying to create nirvana within this shore, together with all beings. It will take more than forever, but somehow we're doing it.
More than forever.
More than forever, yeah. But somehow we're doing it. We never reach the principle of Zazen, and Dogen Zenji said that is the way it should be. Such effort is called dropping off body and mind. If we think that unless we reach the principle of practice, sitting is meaningless, we're simply clinging to the goal. I think this is similar to these other ways we've been talking about, but it's a different twist too, yeah? We attach ourselves to this practice as a means to reach nirvana or enlightenment, practicing without even expecting to reach the goal or principle of Zazen is dropping off body and mind. When we practice with this attitude wholeheartedly, our Zazen is already in nirvana. This is not a method to make deluded human beings into an enlightened Buddha, but this sitting is itself a Buddha's practice. So interestingly, we cannot reach the principle of nirvana. And when we realize that we can't reach the practice, the principle of nirvana, and sit wholeheartedly like that way, that's nirvana. That's how I hear him saying. Right? We can't reach nirvana, but our Zazen is already in nirvana. When we practice with this attitude wholeheartedly, our Zazen's already in nirvana.
We're going to keep doing it till we do, and we never get there, so we're
You know, and the attitude, is there's no thing to gain out there in the future. Wholeheartedly practicing with that attitude, we realize nirvana, which then we see it, nirvana actually wasn't our idea of it out there in the first place. It's this right here. Oh, boy.
Round three.
Yeah, he, thank you, Shohaku Okamura Roshi. He says it much more straightforwardly and succinctly than this convoluted reaching so far for that principle that, like, is not there. It's impossible. It's fun trying, though, huh? It's fun trying, yeah.
Don't you think it's a little difficult to not have a gaining idea?
No.
I mean,
yeah. All kinds of gaining ideas.
What was spoken before about Buddha nature being your driving force, mm-hmm. and not even really being conscious of that, maybe not even knowing why you practice, other than a gaining idea of, oh, I'm serving other people. Oh, I'm doing something that's beneficial, either to myself and to others. Mm. But it always seems to me that there's this baseline of this gaining idea, and I find it really difficult to imagine not having some kind of a gaining idea.
Yeah.
Of either bettering myself, even if it's benefiting others.
You know? Yeah. Well, like this morning in the Shobo Genzo Zui Monkey, Dogen had that very nice piece where he said, well, if we somebody asked him, right, like, well, you said give up all our gaining ideas about being Buddha, then what about just giving up practice completely and just following our desires? And he said, well, that sounds like another gaining idea. So, and then he said, since it's all gaining idea, let's practice virtue and do good. That kind of gaining idea is a better one. So that was kind of one way to hear what he said. And then another way is, I've often thought about this, is like, I think we do need a gaining idea to get up in the morning and come to the Zendo and to come back and sit down again and to get up for Kinyin and to basically everything we do to get ourselves to this place is a greater or lesser gaining idea for ourselves or others. But then there's this kind of secret trick. It seems possible that Zazen is this unusual activity that, like, once we get here with the gaining idea and we're on the cushion, and then we see more gaining ideas on the cushion, like, I guess I should try to concentrate, or, oh, I'm thinking, what am I doing here? It's possible to, like, once you've sort of decided, you maybe even set up some more gaining ideas. Like, I have a gaining idea that I'm going to, like, not move off this cushion for this period. And I have a gaining idea of just, like, letting go of all my gaining ideas. And you set it all up like that. And then that whole combination sometimes makes it like, okay, now I'm just here. And, like, I don't even remember why I came, and in Zazen, there may be times when there's no particular gaining idea. You've probably had.
Well, I keep having this reoccurring theme of, I did it again. We did another session, and I hurt so much everywhere. Why am I doing this?
Remember, don't ask why questions.
Well, so I should just yell, what?
Just like, you know,
yeah so this?
Something brought us here, but it's very nice that you know, once we're here, we don't have to figure out why.
If theoretically everything did reach enlightenment, it would be almost, I mean, like that would be the end of sunrises. That would be the end of phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the end of theater. That would be the end of everything that we want to be enlightened within, it seems like. I mean,
yeah.
I give all this up.
It's funny, you know, because anything we speculate about what that would be like is our thought, our speculations don't reach it, right? But it's again, it's kind of fun sometimes to speculate.
Yeah.
And my teachers, people have asked that, well, what would, you know, same point, same question. I think, well, what about, you know, it sounds almost like the death of the universe.
Yeah.
Right?
To me.
And kind of like, wouldn't maybe be so good? And his take, you know, this is just, it's just speculation, right? But like, it's not that the death of the universe is, it's the death of the universe as we know it. And sunsets and all that stuff as we know it. But that doesn't mean there's nothing. Because Buddha's mind is not nothing. So one speculation could be that it's just boundless, inconceivable love. There's not a universe anymore, but there's boundless, inconceivable love that doesn't even need to, like, you know, put on the play and stuff anymore. We could say, but the play is so nice,
yeah.
And that's why it'll probably keep happening forever. We don't have to worry about it. But if we all said, well, we've done the play long, and you know, so many eons already, let's just for fun end the universe by, like, dropping it off, drop off the universe, everybody at once on three, because
yeah.
We're all bodhisattvas,
yeah.
So you all have to go first, but I don't want to be left behind, because then you couldn't be the bodhisattva. So on the edge of the cliff, on the window ledge, right? On three, ready? One, two and a half, two and three quarters. And maybe it looks like this. Just like in that movie 2001, right, at the end of the universe, after traveling down all the, these, like, wormholes and, like, time warps and, like, way out beyond all, you know, our galaxy and everything, he ends up in this room that looks like a room on Earth. Remember that?
Yes.
You know, very ordinary outside the universe. That was somebody's speculation of some other realm.
Back to the theatrical analogy. Oh, I just have this role to play, so I just better play my role the best I can.
Yeah. Don't ask why. Just play it. Yeah, if we say in the middle of the play, like, these lines seem that the director gave me seem like they don't quite work so well. I'd like to rewrite these and, like, you know, why did you put them like this, director? And the director says, no, just come on, you're on film.
Yeah, man.
You're on camera. Just read them. The director, by the way, is the mirror. So it was dinner time, or must be close. Yeah, amazing. Nothing can really be said, but I think once we decide to do it, then we're just doing it. Maybe possible to just not question why anymore, and not try to make a Buddha, and not try to avoid making a Buddha, and just sit here, and maybe no particular gaining idea, just clearly aware. May our intention equally extend to every being in place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.